Adesso abbiamo l'onore di avere tra di noi Julian Priestley, che è stato segretario generale del Parlamento europeo, oltre che un carissimo amico e un grande europeista e come dire, un grande esperto in generale di questioni politiche ed istituzionali a livello europeo, che ci parlerà di uno dei temi che sono stati peraltro particolarmente a cuore per Renzo Imbeni, su cui ha lavorato moltissimo come vicepresidente del Parlamento europeo, per lungo tempo incaricato di questo, cioè i rapporti fra il Parlamento europeo e i parlamenti nazionali. Julian.
And I'm going to speak English, Luciano, so I don't know whether, because if I speak Italian, my speech will be just too short. But I don't know whether any colleagues will need to get the simultaneous interpretation equipment. Let me first of all say what a great pleasure it is to be here and what a great honor it is to be here. Renzo Imbeni was one of the foremost members of the European Parliament. As Enrique Baron explained this morning, he was absolutely central to the exercise of Parliament's legislative role. And on top of that, as you have just pointed out, and in terms of the theme that we're talking about this afternoon, for part of the time that he was Vice President of Parliament, he was following particularly the question of our relations with national parliaments. And he was always a very moderate, conciliatory voice to try and create a better climate between the national parliaments and Europe's parliament. Parliaments, they're Europe's contribution to governance. We invented parliaments. The Greeks theorized about it. The Romans put it into practice. The first operational parliament was actually in Iceland more than 1,000 years ago. The British changed the brand and developed a form of parliamentarianism in the 19th century, which is held up very often as the model. And the unfortunate thing is that they haven't changed that model since the 19th century. But it is part of our tradition. And so we have, and it's indeed a condition for joining the European Union, that you have a properly functioning parliament. But our 27 parliaments are very different. They're all the same. They don't resemble each other. They have different procedures. They're elected differently. They organize their work in different manners. They even look different. If you go to the Romanian parliament, for example, in the grotesque Palace of the People of President Ceausescu, it's a fantastically modern parliament with smart computers on every desk in the plenary chamber. If you go to the House of Commons, there aren't even enough seats for the members. There are 659 members and 437 seats. So when the chamber is crowded, which isn't always the case, then parliamentarians have to stand up at the back or sit on the floor. So they look different, but they're also organized in a totally different manner. And they organize their European work in a very different manner. Some of them take the whole exercise of scrutiny of European legislation very seriously. Some of them work hard to involve European parliamentarians in their work with joint committees. You know, the Hungarian parliament even allows MEPs to participate in debates on the floor of the House of the Hungarian Parliament on European matters. Can't vote, but they can actually speak as if they were elected national parliamentarians. In other national parliaments, the things are handled differently, and there's very little attempt at scrutiny, and there is a kind of soft curtain between the national and the European parliamentarians. Of course, originally, the European Parliament was an emanation of national parliaments. There was no problem of relations because actually the European parliamentarians were not elected directly to the European Parliament, but they were directly elected to the national parliament. And until 1979, they were part-time European parliamentarians, but who maintained very close links with their parties nationally and had no difficulty in maintaining perfectly correct relations. But everything was easier then because in any case, the European Parliament, except right at the end of that period, didn't have any autonomous powers. It was purely as Lucia has pointed out, a consultative body. So there wasn't any natural tension. And those tensions came to the fore from 1979 onwards. And they came to the fore, I think, for two reasons. I have to say, and I say this with due deference to the two members of the European Parliament present, but who weren't present then in the European Parliament, that there was a certain degree of arrogance portrayed by some members of the European Parliament, who tended to give the impression that they were now members of the federal parliament, vis-a-vis their colleagues who were sitting in little regional bodies in London or Paris or Bonn. And that didn't go down terribly well with the national parliamentarians. And on the other side, the national parliamentarians became quite obsessed with the idea that they were losing influence to Brussels and to Strasbourg, but didn't have the means and didn't try to change the way in which they worked to give them any effective say on day-to-day questions of running the European Union. And so a period of creative tension, but with more tension than creativity, characterized the relations between the national parliaments and the European Parliament. And throughout the period from 1979, many attempts have been made to improve at least the atmospherics and to obtain a degree of cooperation. Part of it is what I would call structural organic. You facilitate the contacts. There's been a great proliferation of bodies for such contacts. Regular meetings, which started at the end of the 1970s, between the presidents of national parliaments and the president of the European Parliament. Meetings, and I've sat through them, and Enrique knows them well, of, how can one put it charitably, mixed usefulness. In part because presidents of parliaments are not always the same thing. The president of the Italian parliament, and we saw a very distinguished ex-president of a parliament this morning, are political protagonists. The president of the European Parliament is, at least institutionally, a political protagonist. The Speaker of the House of Commons is not allowed to utter a word on any matter of political controversy. So apart from perhaps uttering a few comments about the weather or the menu, his role in any political discussion about the future of Europe is likely to be limited. And similarly, when it came to other bodies from for contacts between national and European Parliament, the opportunities were limited by these, if you like, constitutional, national considerations. Set up in the beginning of the 1980s, a body called COSAC. This is an example of Europe's great gift for inventing totally meaningless acronyms for political bodies. It means, if I recall correctly, the Committee of Specialized Bodies Dealing with European Questions. And somehow or another, that becomes COSAC in French. And everybody calls it COSAC because they can't be bothered to work out what it would mean in Italian or German or Greek, etc. And this body brings together little delegations from each of the national parliaments to discuss matters of the moment, hear from the presidency of the union, etc. Again, I think those who have participated regularly in such bodies, such as Inigo Mendes de Vigo, who's here and will be speaking tomorrow, I think will probably agree that, again, the interest and the vitality of those meetings is not always guaranteed. And in part, it's because what exactly is the status? And also, who's there? Isn't there a danger that instead of speaking to the real national experts on agricultural policy or environment policy, you're speaking to those who have, at national level, an interest in European questions, but who may not actually be very representative of their colleagues in the national parliaments? There are regular meetings of the chairs of the foreign affairs committees of the member states and of the European Parliament. And that can be useful because in terms of Europe's external policy, it's a competence which is shared between the national and the European level. But again, it's a question as to the role that a chair of a parliamentary committee can play, particularly under the arrangements for some of our national parliamentarians, of our national parliaments. And similarly, there are other forums that have developed the regular forum to discuss every 6 months between national parliamentarians and European Parliament, rather useful when it comes to preparing a treaty change or an intergovernmental conference. Its long-term usefulness, not absolutely guaranteed. And I think one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, in what way are this proliferation of activities with national parliaments, is it really contributing to making, according to the title of this session, Europe more democratic and closer to its citizens? Do we honestly think that our citizens are aware that there is now a rather intense dialogue between national parliamentarians and European parliamentarians? My hunch is that probably less than 1% of 1% of our citizens know what COSAC is, or know that there are these regular contacts. And I'm not at all convinced that we've moved from what I would call the ritual of a parliamentary dimension and a partnership at the European national level to something which is real and effective. And it seems to me that we may have taken something of a false road. The first point I'd make is the last thing that Europe needs now is an extra institution. It was an attempt at the time of the Convention on the Future of Europe, because of the great interest of the president of the convention, President Giscard d'Estaing, to create a congress or a body of representing national parliaments on a permanent basis. Either that body would have been largely ceremonial and therefore would not have added to the effectiveness of democratic control in the Union, or it would have started to develop influence and in a way which could actually seriously complicate an institutional decision-making structure which is already complicated enough. And I even would have some doubts about the subsidiarity clauses in the treaty. And Inigo Mendes de Vigo was the architect of a compromise with the national parliaments on an early say by national parliaments on subsidiarity issues. My reservation is that I am not at all convinced that most national parliaments have developed the wherewithal to exercise this in a serious fashion. Because the surprising thing is that 30 years after the direct election of the European Parliament, 30 years after you've cut the umbilical cord between national and European parliaments, now completely severed with the abolition of the dual mandate, most national parliaments have not developed an effective scrutiny mechanism for dealing with European questions. There are a few exceptions. Tend to be in the Scandinavian parliaments, where in Denmark, in Sweden, and in Finland, particularly in Denmark and Finland, every week a specialized committee, the Europe Committee, will call in ministers about to go to Brussels the week after and will seek to define with them what should be the line that they take at those ministerial meetings. These people are extremely well-versed in European questions, and they're pragmatic. Being Danes and Finns, they're congenitally pragmatic. And they know that they can't give a mandate which is a straitjacket to their ministers, because the minister has to be able to negotiate. And so it works. Whether it would work in a less consensus-based political system than the one that exists in the Scandinavian countries, I'm not so sure. But it's the only serious method of scrutiny. But interestingly enough, although it's designed to bring the process closer to citizens, these meetings take place in secret, behind closed doors. So it isn't exactly an exercise in public accountability by the national parliamentarians. There's a reason for it, because they're talking about the delicate matter of negotiating positions. But does it really add to the quality of political and democratic control in the Union. But it does seem to me, at least, to be relevant and appropriate. If there is to be some sort of partnership between the European Parliament and the national parliaments, it has to be on the basis of who does what. And that basis must surely be accountability of national ministers to national parliaments for their actions in Europe. But the actual decision-making, the way that decisions on the budget, on legislation, and on executive authority, that those decision-making stays firmly in the hands of the European Parliament for matters that are within the competence of the European Parliament, the competence of Europe. And I think that if that is understood, if that is the basis for cooperation, that is a sensible basis to proceed. But I think if you go further than that, and if you try to give the beginnings of a decision-making role to national parliamentarians, then you add to the dangers of sclerosis at European level. And you have to bear in mind as well that the issues that come before the European Parliament and the European institutions are now extraordinarily complex, and that national parliaments will have difficulty in equipping themselves with the means to exercise those competencies. That if the question of reach was mentioned earlier as a hugely important, highly technical piece of legislation. European Parliament played an enormously creative and positive role in finding a solution to that, which had escaped actually the Commission, which, and there Lucy was absolutely right, the Commission gradually ceding its right of initiative. Parliament took over this horribly complex file and found a solution to it. But it got a lot of help from outside, from experts in the House, outside the House. National parliaments would not be able to deal on a part-time basis with that kind of subject. It is best dealt with at the European level. So I am a skeptic on how far a greater involvement of national parliaments in the work of the European Union is going to deal with the problem. But I think if I could be allowed just a couple of minutes, we'd better perhaps look again at what the problem is. And the problem isn't actually about the involvement of parliamentarians, either national or European, it's the problem of the citizens. And that I think we have come to the end of the road unless we can rekindle amongst our citizens a degree of support and interest in European integration. Now, we can have, as we had over lunch, a long argument about the Irish and to talk about the Irish referendum. But that referendum, entirely symptomatic of a huge problem affecting all the institutions and all the member states, and which is that far from the Union being closer to its citizens, the Union is judged as being more and more remote. And it plays to feelings of helplessness and alienation, which are growing in a society which becomes more complex, in front of executive structures which have become more authoritative, and where the citizen feels that there are impersonal forces which he or she cannot control. And Brussels, unfortunately, is a kind of willing or unwilling, unwitting element in that construct. And what we have to work out, those of us who believe that Europe's survival is dependent on having strong European institutions, is to find ways where we can really make that European Union closer to citizens and make them feel involved. And I don't think we can do it just by describing the very important powers that the European Parliament has, or by saying, and in any case, national parliaments are playing a bigger role. I think it's got to be done elsewhere. And I think at the end of Lucia's remarks just now, she pointed to some of the elements which have to be about involving the citizens in a direct way. And where parliaments are concerned, the most direct way is actually the election to the European Parliament. But you do that not just by having an election in some kind of void, but by having an election of substance, where competing political forces put forward programs about which the outcome of the election can have a big role. Now, at the moment, in most of the member states, first of all, the national political parties, the main vehicle, decide not to devote much in the way of resources to the European election campaigns. They are considered to be very much a secondary event, possibly less important than local elections for the party. I remember, if I can be indiscreet for a moment, I can these days, that the former Prime Minister of Britain, someone I greatly admire, at the time of, in 1999, during the 1999 elections, I became very concerned because it seemed to me that there was no debate in Britain about the European elections and that we were going to have a derisory turnout of less than 30%. And so I said to his spokesman, his representative on earth, that I was very concerned and that the Prime Minister showed no signs. And he said to me, don't worry, the Prime Minister's doing an interview on the television on Sunday. And that was the contribution by the leader of the British government and the leader of the Labour Party to that election campaign. He went on television once. And you compare that with the saturation coverage of national elections where every party leader is fighting to get in through every media every single minute of the day. And we're surprised that the result and the outcome in those elections is mediocre. But it isn't just that the efforts made by our parties, including the resources to it, I mean, we can't expect to match the Americans. I mean, whoever wins the White House in November will have spent upwards of $500 million for the privilege. We can't expect, and we shouldn't try to rival that, but nonetheless, we could make a bit more of an effort than the paltry attempts that we make at the moment. But then there's a question of what are the elections about? And the fact of the matter is that although there are embryonic political parties at the European level, no one is aware that they exist, they have no democratic life or vitality, and their programs are platitudinous. They don't say anything. But in fact, the elections decide a great deal. It's just that no one has said what they will decide before the elections take place. So that, for example, the elections will decide who's in the majority in the Commission, but they'll also decide our environmental policy for the next few years. That will be directly the result of the elections. On the reform of the finances of the EU, which is going to be coming up in 2009, and whether Parliament will have absolutely a determinant role with the Council of Ministers on that, with or without the Lisbon Treaty, or on the social Europe, or on human rights, on development aid and the Millennium Goals, etc. All of those things, those elections in June next year will have a very major impact on. And yet the danger is that those elections are transformed by political parties at the national level into a referendum on Mr. Sarkozy, on Mr. Brown, on Mrs. Merkel, on Mr. Zapatero. And yet, in fact, those elections will not decide the fate of Mrs. Merkel, Mr. Sarkozy, Mrs. Merkel, etc., etc. They'll have no impact whatsoever on that. And it's because of that cynical misappropriation of those elections that our electors think, well, actually, if they don't talk about the European issues, that actually means the European Parliament isn't that important, so why should I bother to go and vote? Or if I go and vote, I will use my vote in a more or less frivolous protest manner. And that, to me, is what is the relevant response, making those elections as a first step, and only a first step, but making those elections real elections to a parliament, that will involve citizens. And the rest, relations with national parliaments, the rest is important, but it will not solve our problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Julian. credo che ci abbia dato un quadro molto interessante e realistico, diciamo così, del tema del rapporto con i parlamenti nazionali, anche diciamo riportandolo, credo, alle giuste dimensioni, anche se con l'eventuale entrata in vigore del Trattato di Lisbona e quindi una partecipazione codificata dei parlamenti nazionali nella fase ascendente del processo legislativo, evidentemente il tema si porrà con più forza e soprattutto ci ha richiamato all'importanza del core business, cioè del fatto che in realtà uno dei passaggi fondamentali dell'affermazione della dimensione democratica partecipativa dell'Unione Europea è dare un senso maggiore, un senso maggiormente politico e maggiormente europeo alla scadenza delle elezioni del Parlamento Europeo.